You have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s. Standing on your head. Yow!
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, it's the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. On today's program, we bring you the latest headlines from the Electronic Intifada podcast with host Nora Barrows Friedman. Later in the show, we present an encore broadcast of our recent interview with United Farm Workers co-founder Dolores Huerta. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up first, the latest headlines from the Electronic Intifada with host Nora Barrows Friedman.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 47 of the ceasefire. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, the holy month of Ramadan has begun, but Palestinians are bracing for yet more scarcity of food and supplies after Israel ordered the crossings to be closed on March 2nd, in violation of the ceasefire terms and international law. Israel's order to close the crossings was seen by Palestinian civil society as an act of sabotage against the ceasefire agreement, as it is supposed to move on to stage two of the three stages that began in January. Israeli Prime Minister and war crimes suspect Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Hamas with even more consequences if it does not agree to extend phase one of their ceasefire agreement and release the remaining Israeli captives held in Gaza, which was not laid out in the stage one process. The Hamas political party responded that the Israeli government's move to close the crossings and cut off international aid was, quote, cheap extortion, a war crime, and a blatant attack on the ceasefire. The Palestinian Foreign Affairs Ministry stated that it rejected Israel's use of, quote, politicizing aid and using it as a means of blackmail, deepening the suffering of more than 2 million Palestinians, adding to their current state of suffering due to the genocidal war and displacement. Euromed Human Rights Monitor noted that senior Israeli officials have made public, openly genocidal statements in the last few days, including Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich saying Israel should open, quote, the gates of hell. Smotrich declared that halting the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza is an important step in the right direction, further stating that Israel must open those gates as quickly and lethally as possible on the cruel enemy until absolute victory. Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Sa'ar dismissed warnings from the United Nations and international organizations regarding the risk of renewed famine in the Gaza Strip amid the tightened blockade and halting of humanitarian aid. Sa'ar said he considered these warnings to be, quote, just a lie, and affirmed that the Israeli government has no commitment to delivering humanitarian aid. Israeli Knesset member Almog Cohen urged Israeli forces to kill Palestinians in Gaza, quote, with no mercy during the holy month of Ramadan, saying it is, quote, the best time to kill them because they are weak and tired. Reporting from a market in Khan Yunis, Al Jazeera's Tariq Abu Azoum said on Wednesday that, quote, prices have skyrocketed due to the potential scarcity of products and in light of the large consumption of people who have started to store food in preparation for the renewed starvation of the territory as long as the Israeli decision will remain in place. The United Nations World Food Program stated on Wednesday that it only has enough food stores to keep public kitchens and bakeries open for fewer than 2 weeks, as long as the crossings remain sealed. The Gaza Government Media Office stated on Tuesday that the continuation of the ban on food, medicine, and basic supplies, quote, means the return of the specter of famine again. The health situation will also continue to worsen, the office added, quote, by preventing the entry of medicines and medical supplies, which means a death sentence for thousands of chronic patients and the injured due to the lack of health care, and a death sentence for the health system that has already collapsed due to the deliberate sabotage and destruction of the occupation army for 15 months. In addition to the banning of aid and medicine, Israel has continued to refuse to allow in heavy machinery, tents, and housing caravans as it agreed to under the ceasefire terms. Speaking to the Turkish Anadolu news agency, Salama Maruf of the government media office said that Gaza requires 200,000 tents, but only about half of that number had been delivered before the closures. Only 15 mobile homes have entered Gaza, he added, while 60,000 are needed to accommodate displaced families. Officials in the Palestinian health sector, as well as international aid organizations in Gaza, warn that if the closures remain in effect and if the ceasefire does not hold, there will be devastating consequences for Palestinians struggling to survive. The International Rescue Committee says it has gathered 6.7 tons of much-needed pharmaceutical and medical supplies for hospitals in Gaza, which was due to arrive this week but is now blocked by Israel. The aid organization Islamic Relief warned that, quote, a return to the relentless horror and atrocities that we saw for more than 15 months would be a global failure of staggering proportions. The UK group Medical Aid for Palestinians stated that, quote, a year ago, the International Court of Justice ordered measures to prevent genocide in Gaza, but by again blocking aid, Israel continues to violate them. Its return to total siege should be resolutely condemned by the international community, including the UK government, which must now take immediate action to ensure aid access is fully restored and international law is enforced. Mohammed Al-Khatib, the group's deputy director of programs in Gaza, said, quote, it is a continuation of the mockery of humanity and double standards toward the civilian population of the Gaza Strip, and the world is still standing by, watching. Clean water remains in critical shortages across Gaza. This week, the municipality of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza announced that its two desalinization plants have stopped working due to the lack of fuel to run the electricity generators. Journalist and researcher Maha Husseini of the Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported from the dialysis clinic at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City on Wednesday, where she said, quote, all machines have suddenly stopped working due to a lack of water. The machines have been shut down for the day and patients were sent home until the water tanks are refilled. Israel has destroyed around 90% of Gaza's water wells and 80% of its water infrastructure, making access to water a daily struggle for both individuals and hospitals, she added. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of In Gaza's Ruins, A Different Kind of War by Abdullah Yunus, writing from Gaza. Abdullah profiles several families living in unsafe conditions as Netanyahu shut the crossings once more. He writes that, quote, after 15 months of forced displacement, Mutasim Zahed and his family were able to return to their home in Jabalia in northern Gaza. The family of six had endured more than a year of relentless Israeli attacks, but the ceasefire that allowed for the family's return to their badly damaged home did not mean that their struggle for survival was over. The widespread destruction wrought by Israel and the lack of essential infrastructure and insufficient humanitarian assistance has left Palestinians in Gaza like Mutasim and his family feeling they are now enduring a different kind of war. When Mutasim, 53 years old, returned to his home, he found that the walls had collapsed and the ceiling was cracked. It was no longer suitable for him and his family. After they could not find a tent or a shelter center to receive them, Mutasim said that their only option was to try to repair part of their dilapidated home using wood and nylon sheeting. "We sleep in fear that the ceiling will collapse on our heads at any moment, but it is still better than staying in the street," Mutasim told the Electronic Intifada. At night, the family remains alert for any noises that might indicate structural failure. "We no longer know which is more dangerous, staying under this cracked ceiling or going out into the open without shelter," Mutasim said. With basic infrastructure in the area destroyed, Mutasim is forced to walk for hours in search of any working water well. He often returns with a small bucket that is not enough to meet the family's needs for one day. "We live on drops of water, and we wash our faces with an amount that is not enough for a child," he said. Ala Zahed, Mutasim's wife, pointed to Israel's deliberate manufacturing of the catastrophic conditions their family is being subjected to. "We feel like we are living inside a time bomb that could collapse on us at any moment," she said, referring to the family's severely damaged home. "Why does Israel not allow the entry of caravans and tents into the strip as stipulated in the ceasefire agreement?" That is an excerpt from Abdullah Yunus's feature in Gaza's Ruins, A Different Kind of War on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, our contributor Zeina El-Tahan writes about Israel's military assault on the Al-Farah refugee camp in the northern occupied West Bank, part of a wider and ongoing string of attacks that began in mid-January in the Jenin, Nablus, and Tulkarem areas. Zeina writes that at least 60 Palestinians have been killed and dozens more wounded across the northern West Bank since the start of the operation. Some 40,000 Palestinians have been forced from their homes, with the Jenin, Tulkarem, and Nur Shams refugee camps almost completely emptied. She adds that Israeli soldiers occupied Palestinian homes in Al-Farah camp and used them as military outposts during their 11-day assault last month, leaving behind feces, urine, and used condoms. Fida Abu Zeina's home was one of them. Abu Zeina, 46, his wife and three children were forced out at gunpoint on February 2nd, the first day of the assault. Given their home's location at the entrance to the camp, theirs was the first case of expulsion. Using his home as a military outpost, soldiers lived, slept, and ate in Abu Zeina's home for 11 days, during which they vandalized it beyond recognition, leaving a stench of urine and feces and used condoms on the floor and in the closets. Quote, "I lost my mind when I saw the inside of my home for the first time after they withdrew. It's a garbage dump. It's uninhabitable. There's no home anymore," Abu Zeina, a former welder, told the Electronic Intifada from his bare living room, which he had to empty of all the furniture that had been ruined by soldiers. "They told us we had 5 minutes to grab our belongings and leave and to come back a month later," Abu Zeina said. "The soldiers tried to force us to leave the camp, but I refused. I told them they can bomb my house and me along with it. In the end, they let me go to my father's house in another part of the camp." Israel's current assault is the longest in the occupied West Bank in more than two decades, and it is the largest operation of forcible displacement there since 1967. Israeli military vehicles rampaging through the streets of Jenin on March 4th. The Palestinian rights group Al-Haq said that the entire city of Jenin was completely sealed off, with all entrances and exits blocked on day 43 of the large-scale Israeli military assault. Israeli occupying forces launched their third phase of their attack on Jenin, sending in a large number of military vehicles, including 10 Eitan armored carriers, Apache helicopter gunships, and reconnaissance drones, Al-Haq said. Read Zeina Al-Tahan's report, Israeli soldiers vandalize and desecrate West Bank homes, on electronicintifada.net for much more. Meanwhile, Defense for Children International Palestine reports that 2 weeks after Israeli forces arrested and detained a 14-year-old child from his home in Beit Fajar, south of Bethlehem, during a pre-dawn raid, a 4-month administrative detention order was issued against him this week. Muin Ghassan Fahad Salahat, the group says, is the youngest Palestinian child placed under an administrative detention order since DCIP began monitoring child administrative detainees in 2008. Israeli soldiers forcibly entered Muin's home at 3:40 in the morning on February 19th, DCIP states. Muin's father was immediately detained, blindfolded, and restrained with his hands behind his back. When Muin awoke and went to find his father, Israeli soldiers seized him and began searching the house. The family was not given an arrest warrant and were told not to move, while soldiers damaged their belongings and confiscated phones and a computer. The soldiers attempted to blindfold Muin and tie his hands behind his back as they took him away. Afterward, a soldier warned Muin's father not to move for at least 10 minutes. Administrative detention violates fundamental due process rights, yet Israeli forces are now expanding this draconian policy to detain Palestinian children indefinitely without charge or trial, said Ayed Abu Aktesh, Accountability Program Director at DCIP. Muin's case sets a dangerous precedent, showing that no Palestinian child, regardless of age, is safe from arbitrary imprisonment under Israel's military rule, he added. Muin, a ninth-grade student and the only child in his family, has been placed under administrative detention, a practice in which Israeli authorities detain Palestinians, including children, without charge or trial based on secret evidence that neither the detainee nor their lawyer can review. Israeli forces are holding 112 Palestinian children in administrative detention as of December 31, 2024, according to information shared by the Israel Prison Service, the highest number of child detainees since DCIP began monitoring this number in 2008. Finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing determination and resilience across Palestine. In the occupied West Bank, Mohammed Al-Maleh, who is in Israeli prison for 29 years and was recently released during prisoner exchange, was able to finally be with his family and break their fast together on the first day of Ramadan. He says, quote, "Despite all the tragedies and circumstances that we live through on a daily basis, we always have the ability to find moments of joy, and this gathering is one of those moments." An older relative says that this Ramadan is special because their hero is back.
دائما عندنا القدرة ان احنا خلينا نقول نسرق لحظات فرح وبعتقد هذه الجمعة هي واحدة من هذه اللحظات.
And in Gaza, amongst the rubble in Rafah, dining tables were lined up as far as the eye can see, preparing for an iftar meal. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network, and we are happy to have you along with us today. And I'm happy to have along with me, Miguel Gavilan Molina, as we welcome to these airwaves the legendary Dolores Huerta. She's the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. Dolores is one of the most influential labor activists of the 20th and 21st century. She's a leader in the Chicano civil rights movement. Throughout her work with the United Farm Workers, Huerta organized workers, negotiated contracts, advocated for safer working conditions, including the elimination of harmful pesticides. Dolores, welcome back to Flashpoints. The work that you've done, all the extraordinary organizing that you've done, do you feel it's in jeopardy with this fascist that's now become the president of the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I like to say it's like we're having to try to get back all of the rights that we got after the Civil War. You know, where people finally got the right to vote, the South, black people got the right to vote in the South. And the other advances that we made after we also made back in the 60s, and even if we go all the way back to the War of Independence for the United States of America to be free from the dictatorship of the King of England. And now we have to come back and fight for all of those rights, the civil rights that we got, the fight for democracy. So we've all got to become patriots now to try to save our country, the United States of America, if not the world, because if a democracy goes down in the United States, then we can assume that that's going to happen also in the rest of the world.
Does it blow your mind that literally our country has been given over to billionaires, taken over, seized by billionaires? It's a real challenge, absolutely. Isn't it?
Well, I think that it's been around, and all of us have sort of been conditioned to live by it, to live by the rule by the corporate world. And it's been here, but it hasn't gotten to these heights that it is right now. When we think that our resources, our natural resources, in the United States are owned by corporations, we have corporations that own our water, corporations that own our electricity systems, corporations that are now getting into the point where they control our food supply and the prices of our food supply. And so we've been going down this road for a while, but it wasn't as blatant as what we are seeing now. And the one thing that I am hoping that will come out of this current struggle that we're going into now is that we finally start to address the fact that we cannot have corporations govern us as has been happening. We have no control, again, as I mentioned before, over the price of water that we drink or the gasoline that we use and now the food that we eat. We have many corporations now that own farms, and they're controlling what's going to happen to the food that we eat, the way they control the price of gasoline. So it's a corporate control of our society. And one of the things that, as I said, that I hope comes out of this next struggle, and we start to address that. Because, so far we're just letting it go by and living with it, and everything, the prices keep going up and we keep paying. But at some point we have to say, hey, it doesn't have to be that way. We could look at other countries that they own their natural resources, that the government does and not the corporations.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're honored to be joined by Dolores Huerta. She's the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, along with Cesar Chavez. She is the recipient of many honors, including the Eleanor Roosevelt Human Rights Award and the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012. Dolores, we're joined by a friend of yours, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Miguel, welcome to Flashpoints. I know that this visit by this beautiful icon of civil rights has everything to do with your work with the program, and you're not new to the farm workers, are you, Gavilan?
Well, like so many of us coming out of the Chicano reality, we all came out of the fields of misery or packing houses or even working on docks on the coast. But one thing that really I'm concerned about, Dolores, is that, you know, a couple of weeks ago, with very little press coverage, they dismantled the National Labor Relations Board, which I believe is the one where unions have this, access to filing complaints, to, you know, suing people, to bringing law and order to illegal activities by corporations or companies that exploit workers. But now, with that board being dismantled and its officials dismissed, what does that do for collective bargaining? It really concerns me, because that's the power of the unions. And you know, the last 10, 20 years, unions finally, you know, and a lot of that union activity where workers finally organized and at the beginning had to fight the police, you know, and had to fight armed security, you know, of the corporations and the corporate bosses to establish unions. And a lot of that happened here in California, in the Bay Area. But what does this mean, Dolores? You know, and I also hear that they've been canceling, the government has already been canceling, you know, contracts, you know, and agreements with unions. What is that going to do, cutting, you know, collective bargaining from, you know, the ability of unions to use that power?
Well, we don't know where it's going to end. I don't know if, I know that the unions are suing, and this is all going to be going to court. I imagine they'll end up in the Supreme Court, and we don't know what the Supreme Court will do. But for them to start dismantling the protections that workers have under the National Yes. Labor Relations Board and the Act is disgraceful. And not only that, Gavilan, I think they're going to go further. They're firing of all of these government workers. They are going to try to privatize a lot of the jobs that people have that the government, you know, and most of those workers are union workers. They belong to the American Federation of Government Employees Union. They're going to start privatizing a lot of the work that the government now has and that it pays, and they're going to be giving out their contracts to their friends. This is like what happened in the Soviet Union. You know, this is what they did in Russia. A lot of the work that they had that was paid by the government, they started doling it off to all of their friends, you know? And part of it, of course, is to break labor, to break the union movement in the United States of America. And I guess the question is, are we going to be able to survive the next 4 years? But you know what? We have a lot of great people out there like yourself, KPFA, and other organizations. We're just going to have to band together. And, you know, I mentioned a few moments ago about, you know, the war for independence that we had, trying to create a democracy and getting out under the rule of the King of England. And out of the, you know, out of that came the democracy, the Constitution of the United States of America. And again, during the Civil War, to get rid of slavery. And we've been fighting to get rid of the legacy of slavery. So now we've all got to become patriots to save the democracy. All of us have got to put ourselves, you might say, in the shoes of the people that fought for the independence of the United States of America, because the people that are now in charge don't believe in democracy. They believe in autocracy and dictatorship and fascism. And so we have a, I don't know, we have to kind of put ourselves in the shoes of the people that were there during World War II, and maybe not have to go to war in a military style, but we're having to think about how we're going to defend ourselves, but also not just defend ourselves, but how we are going to organize to save our democracy and defeat the fascists that are now in government. And it's just so many of us that have organized for so many years, and we see what's happening, it's a nightmare coming to life, you might say, something most of us thought we would never see in our country.
So true, Dolores. I mean, it's such a shocking reality. You know, every morning I wake up and I look out the window and, you know, for some reason, I don't want to see a red sky, you know, where there's world war. I mean, it's, we're so close to just like complete, you know, chaos and breakdown, not just in the country here, but around the planet. But the dismantling of the government, tearing apart the Constitution and demolishing the press. I mean, that's all happening. And sometimes I find myself, you know, ¿qué onda? What's happening? Why aren't people reacting? You know, and I've always said there's so many distractions, you know, on television, on the screen, on this and that, that a lot of people aren't paying attention or just so busy trying to put food on the table, pay the rent, pay the bills, you know, keep yourself afloat, that people aren't really paying attention. And, you know, the dictatorship now that has taken over the White House is just, you know, just railroading this thing through. But one thing that I know and I learned it from, you know, as a young kid, when I first saw the United Farm Workers flag, when I went to Leno in 1966 with my tío and my padrino and some of their compadres to the first walk in 1966. And I remember it was just so empowering for me as a little chavalo. I'd never been around so many Mexicanos that weren't afraid of the Migra, the INS in those days. Now it's ICE. But one thing that I learned, and I kept it throughout high school, even college, and onward to date, is it organizing. And Dolores, you know, you established the Dolores Huerta Foundation, which organizes, you know, young folks, young people, you know, to go back into communities. Is that work still happening? Because it is so important, so essential right now that people organize, you know, not just their barrios, their communities, but organize, you know, help organize their town, you know, their municipalities, and reach out to other groups. I know that the success of the United Farm Workers happened when yourself and Cesar, you know, made the decision, hey, we have to take this on the road. And you took it to college campuses, you know, where at that point, at that time, we were fighting to get, you know, more brown folks, more African American, more Asians, you know, in higher education. And there was a union. And I said, wow, look at that. Do you see something like that happening, Dolores, where we need to get back to grassroots and take it on the road and reach out to other communities?
Oh, absolutely. The one good thing that we have is stations like yours, of course, KPFA, that has always given people the kind of information that they need. And that is so important because we know not only are they just shutting down the newsmakers, but they're also, you know, they have this now established a whole chain of misinformation. Last night, right after President Trump's speech, I happened to tune in on a television station called Newsmax. And I have suspected that this was a right-wing station, TV station, because they had Bill O'Reilly on the show. You know, somebody that we tried to get banned because of his constant attack on Latinos. And then they had this show about the Panama Canal with complete lies, saying how the United States had built the Panama Canal. You know, which is a complete lie. And then, you know, again, this is, you know, kind of one of Trump's the things that he said he's going to take over the Panama Canal. And then on this misinformation and the way that they presented it, it looked like, yeah, the United States built the Panama Canal and we should take it back. These lies are going to be perpetuated. And this is why it's so important, the stations like KPFA, that they exist. I know just before we got on that there was a call there for people to donate. Yeah, more than ever, we have to keep stations like yours alive, KPFA.
Dolores, this is Dennis. Let me just jump in here for a second. Sorry to interrupt. Let people know that is the voice of Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. You're hearing that voice, that powerful voice, on KPFA Pacifica Radio here in the Bay Area. We are honored. We have been honored because of our special status as a listener-sponsored. We represent the people. We've been honored to work with the United Farm Workers for years and years. That's where Miguel, our senior producer now, who is on with us, that's where his life started. I want to know, is there a special place now, Dolores, for young people? I'm thinking that this might be the exact right moment for a new generation of young union organizers to be out there doing the work. I'm wondering how that's happening. Are you passing the baton?
Oh, absolutely. We see that is happening not only with union organizers today. Today, here in Bakersfield, California, SEIU, Service Employees International Union, they had a big strike. They are having a strike against the Board of Supervisors here. They had 3,000 people on the picket line today. They shut down all of the county offices in Bakersfield today, because they've been trying to negotiate a contract for a long time now. And the Board of Supervisors, even though they have increased the amount of money that they've been able to take in, revenues, they are refusing to sign a contract with the workers group. And they've been trying to negotiate for a long time. It was so awesome. In fact, as we speak right now, they are picketing in the rain here in Bakersfield, California today. We had recent marches against what ICE is doing here. We were Kern County. We were the first county to be hit by the Border Patrol and the ICE people in terms of arresting people that were undocumented. So the high school students walked out here in Bakersfield spontaneously. They planned it themselves. The high school kids walked out. So we see this is happening, of course, in Los Angeles. They've had these huge marches in the Bay Area. So we see it happening. The young kids are stepping up big time. And, you know, the one thing that they have that we didn't have, Gabby Long, back in there in the early days, they have the Internet. They have their cell phones. They can mobilize. They can communicate. They can get things together very, very fast. So these young folks, they're going to be the ones that are going to be leading the charge to fight the fascist moment that we're in right now.
Amazing. Dolores, can you stay with us a few more minutes?
Sure.
Beautiful. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to keep talking with our honored guest, Dolores Huerta, founder of the United Farm Workers. We've got our own Miguel Gavilan Molina, who has his own experience with the farm workers. And this is Free Speech Pacifica KPFA here in the Bay Area. Please stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina and our guest of honor today, Dolores Huerta, and we are hoping that you will stand with us and with the kind of programming that KPFA provides, and our honor to have as a guest many times Dolores Huerta and others at the United Farm Workers, being on the ground with them, our own Gavilan Molina walking the walk, hundreds of miles for worker rights. Gavilan, it must be amazing for you to be here with Dolores on the air. I guess you never thought about that when you're back there working in the fields, fields of misery.
Well, yes, Dennis, and it's something I think we all have in common, but thank the Creator, Tonatzin, that we've got in the movement, in the Chicano movement, what I call, you know, the mother of the movement, which is Dolores. Her energy, her enthusiasm, just has always ignited all of us, given us hope. And, of course, that rallying cry, nobody can throw that rallying cry of si se puede, like Dolores. And I have been there throughout the decades. But one thing that I do know is this, and that's, you know, that this particular thing, even though the current administration under its dictatorship, you know, are trying to paint it otherwise, you know, it is you know, if we really look at it, this is a complete destruction of democracy, and where greed and hatred is destroying this country. But fortunately, we, yourself, myself, Dennis, Mike, the station, Dolores Huerta Foundation, the United Farm Workers, and other groups, you know, we are the voices of reasoning. And especially in these times of so much noise and distraction, and they turn the English language into a language of lies and lies chronically. But we are true to power. And one thing that I do know, Dolores, is that the undocumented workforce in this country is, you know, is something, I've heard a number, something like 30% of the labor force. Well, that's an essential group of workers, you know, from being farm workers to domestic workers to day laborers and construction workers and other, you know, intense physical labor, you know, jobs. You know, they are a legitimate workforce. And there are people that begin to realize, hey, they might be undocumented, but they're part of communities. But right now, you know, the country and everything has gotten such a critical, you know, what I call chainsaw, you know, stance. You know, we've seen Musk, you know, who bought the presidency and now speaks from the Oval Office. But all of that, we know, is a direct threat to democracy and workers. I know that what the recent cuts, what $800 billion and you know, to Medicaid and food stamps, that's going to affect 80, you know, million recipients of Medicaid and 40 million people that receive and depend on food stamps. And when that comes down to workers, and especially poor, you know, the poor working class, the lowest wage earners, you know, which sometimes are farm workers, how can we battle that? You know, I know some people are setting up food banks. Some people are really extending that kind of thing. Other people are starting to grow community gardens. But at this point, you know, food is going to be what I feel weaponized in this country and used again, you know, to force groups or communities or even complete regions to abide by this unbelievable corrupt government and what is happening to our democracy, you know, on the reign of terror and this presidency of fear. How can we push back the Lotus?
Well, the only way is what you said before, is to organize. We have to organize the resistance, and we know that a lot of us are going to get hit in doing that, but we have to continue. And there's one other thing, too, that is very scary, and that is the fact that they are turning their backs on what's happening with the global warming, you know, that drill, baby, drill, that is going to make the planet even hotter. And I don't know if we can, you know, 4 years from today, what it's going to look like. But there are things that we can do. Number one is we have to start preparing for the elections. We're going to have elections in the for the Congress, you know, a year and months from now. And we can start really start organizing to make sure we get more Democrats in the Congress. The other thing, and I do want to ask everybody to join in this. There is a what is now being called an economic fast, to withhold buying at some of these corporations that have gotten rid of their diversity, inclusion, and equity programs at the bidding of Donald Trump. And the Reverend Bryant from the South, and Stacey Abrams and others, they are going to, and many of their pastors, the ministers in the Black community, are banding together nationwide, and they already have tens of thousands of people committed that they are going to not shop at Target at that sort during Lent. It's starting with Ash Wednesday. They're asking people for 40 days, do not shop. And then at Target. And why Target? Because Target was one of the stores that came out there right after George Floyd was killed. and reached out to the black community, their CEO. He said this, where George Floyd was killed was very close to the headquarters of Target. And they came out and they said, we're going to help black businesses. You know, we're going to do the diversity, inclusion, and equity. And they, you know, they were going to do, and some of the things they did, that they did do what they said they were going to do. But because of Trump's asking all of the government agencies to stop their DEI policies, their diversity and inclusion and equity policies, then these stores are, these corporations are following Trump's lead, and they're stopping this. And so the only way that we can combat this was with our dollars. And you know, Gavilan, and you will remember this, that when the farm workers, we had our big 5 years strike. We had a strike for 5 years, and we could not win. And it wasn't until we did a grape boycott, a lettuce boycott, yellow wine boycott, that we won. When the 17 million people of our United States of America decided not to buy grapes or shop at stores to carry grapes, that's how we won. And this is how we win again. By, they want to fight, but we're going to fight also, but we're going to do passive, nonviolent resistance. We're just not going to shop at those stores that are going to follow Trump's policies. And we ask everybody to join us, please.
Dolores, we're always grateful to have you. And I suspect that Free Speech Radio, KPFA, the People's Radio, has been a key, played a key part in organizing for the United Farm Workers. Would that be true?
Absolutely. They were, KPFA, KPFK, were the only radio stations that supported our movement for many, many years. It became popular. But you were always the first ones out there. And in the archives, you have many conversations that you had, not only with Cesar, with myself, with Dorothy Day, Father Boyle, Father Gene Boyle, all of these people that were great supporters of the farm workers. And you have been, you might say, at many times you were the only anchor that we had, the only outlet that we had to share our message and to get people to support us. And to this day.
Beautiful. Well, Dolores, thank you. You do have a birthday coming up, is that true?
Well, that's true. On April 10th is my birthday. And that is kind of a special day, too, because I was fortunate to be born on April 10th, but it's also the day of Emiliano Zapata Saints Day. Because that is
yes.
The day that they took his life.
Thank you, Dolores. People love you. We appreciate it.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.